Welcome to the Book Chooks, where we talk about books with your host, Librarian Selena.
I love reading books, it's fun. I often read them with my mum. I like reading to explore. There's no better way, I'm sure. I love reading.
Right here on Planet 104.6 FM. Stay tuned for the next half hour as we find more great books to read. Good evening, readers and listeners. Tonight we have librarian Karen Craig from Central City Library back with us to share some prize-winning books and reading challenges. Welcome back, Karen.
Thank you, Selena.
What have you got there? What prize-winning books have you got?
Well, what prize might be the question. So I've brought a couple of books from the Bailey's Prize, which has just been announced. The winner has just been announced. And I have brought the winner and a sort of a, what you might call a handmaiden, one of the runner-ups, or a bridesmaid, possibly. I believe, actually, in book prizes, it is called that, because the people who are always listed but never win are called always a bridesmaid, never a bride.
Oh.
So I've brought a book called The Power, which has just been awarded the Bailey's Prize for Fiction. Now, the Bailey's Prize is the one most people recognize as the Orange Prize. When it was started up in 1996, it was called the Orange Prize. It was the first prize set up to recognize fiction written by women.
Okay.
Not for women, necessarily.
Right.
But by women. And the reason for this was that it was felt in the establishment, a lot of people said, oh, this is discriminatory. Why do we want a prize for just women? Germaine Greer famously said, oh, well, then why don't we just have a prize for people with red hair? And and the fact is that what most people who got behind the idea of a women's fiction prize, a prize for fiction written by women.
Women writers.
Definitely women's fiction is not a term that we like. Was that there actually already is a prize for men, in the sense that almost all the literary prizes existing were skewed towards male winners, and especially the general literary establishment. So there were some figures that came out around that time that, for instance, 88% of the books reviewed in the New York Times are written by men. So that leaves 12% of books written by women. This is recent statistics.
Yeah.
In the United Kingdom, the London Review of Books reviewed 195 books by men to 68 books by women. And the New York Review of Books had 677 men to 242 women. So that's your first answer to the question, why a prize for women? Why recognition, special recognition for women? And the other answer is, I think, that prizes are fun. Rather than worry about having a prize for women or a prize for people with red hair, bring it on. Let's have a prize for writers with dyed hair. Let's have a prize.
Let's have red and black hair.
Yeah, and black hair. A prize for people who enjoy old automobiles and have written a book about it. So the thing that's really great about prizes is if you're looking for a good book to read, you can Google a prize, you can Google prizes. The Auckland Library's website has a page about book prizes. The website is underway. A new website is coming up, so I can't swear that that page is exactly where one would think. But at any rate, we do cover book prizes.
Yeah.
And we write about them in the books blog, Books in the City, on the Auckland Library's website.
Yeah.
So there's one coming up soon which will cover all these prizes. And you can really find great books, or whether it's the winner or whether it's the books that have been shortlisted or books that have been longlisted.
Yeah.
So The Power is a thriller, and it has a quote from Margaret Atwood on the cover, electrifying, which is a bit of an inside joke if you know about the book, because the story of the book is that the premise is that teenage girls suddenly discover that they have the ability to kill people with a touch.
What?
Yes.
Okay.
Set in the future.
Right.
Set in what we call the dystopian future.
Only teenage girls, though.
Teenage girls. Well, teenage girls, because there's solidarity among women, pass it on to older women. So soon all the women in the world know how to kill people with a single touch.
Oh.
And it's apparently, there is a scientific, it's a bit science fiction, so there was a buildup of environmental byproducts of agents that were used in World War II or something that have caused this. But at any rate, the point of the story is that the women can kill men with a single touch, can kill anyone with a single touch, but they mostly use it against oppressive males of whatever, or violent males. And the great part of the story, so it follows three girls in particular, who cover the various aspects of the ethical questions around something like this. So one has more of a political slant, one has more of a criminal slant, and one has more of a religious slant.
Okay.
And it follows also one male who is a Nigerian who's the first person to capture the act on camera with his phone camera of a man actually being killed with the touch of a woman. And through this story, it takes you up to when there's a whole new world order, let's say, established.
Oh.
And the really interesting part of the book is when you get as far as the new world order, which is where I've gotten,
right,
is to discover that the new world order is not a perfect world order and it's not a more just world, but it's actually...
It's just new.
It's just new, exactly. Well said. Because women actually discover they enjoy being bad because they can be bad.
Oh, no.
So it's full of thought experiments. It's a book for people who enjoy thought experiments, but it is a page-turner.
Kind of like Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's in that line of imagining, or Fahrenheit 451, imagining a world in which there are what's normally known as dystopian world.
Dystopian.
Yeah, dystopian world. So
wow.
Not the perfect world that people might imagine, not the utopia.
Yeah.
But the dystopia.
Dystopia. Yeah.
So I marked a passage I thought I could read to give people an idea, give them a taste of this book. Naomi Alderman, the author, this is not her first novel, but it's the first novel that she's become famous for. So we're talking about the starts out with about the reports on this new power that they've discovered women have. She has read the preliminary reports out of the CDC, noting that the power particularly affects the pain centers of the human brain, meaning that while it looks like electrocution, it hurts more than it needs to. It's a targeted pulse which sets up a response in the body's pain receptors. Nonetheless, she'd expected it to look like something, to see her flesh crisping and wrinkling, or to watch the arcing current quick as a snake's bite. Instead, she smells the scent of wet leaves after a rainstorm, an apple orchard with the windfalls turning to rot, just as it was on her parents' farm. And then it hurts. From the place on her forearm, where Joss is touching her, it starts as a dull bone ache, the flu traveling through the muscles and joints. It deepens. Something is cracking her bone, twisting it, bending it, and she wants to tell Joss to stop, but she can't open her mouth. It burrows through the bone like it's splintering apart from the inside. She can't stop herself seeing a tumor, a solid, sticky lump bursting out through the marrow of her arm, splitting the ulna and the radius to sharp fragments. She feels sick. She wants to cry out. The pain radiates across her arm and nauseatingly through her body. There's not a part of her it hasn't touched now. She feels it echo in her head and down her spine, across her back, around her throat and out, spreading across her collarbone. The collarbone. It has only been a few seconds, but the moments have elongated. Only pain can bring such attention to the body. This is how Margot notices the answering echo in her chest. Among the forests and mountains of pain, a chiming note along her collarbone, like answering to like. It reminds her of something, a game she played when she was a girl. How funny, she hasn't thought of that game in years. She never told anyone about it. She knew she mustn't, although she couldn't say how she knew. In the game, she was a witch, and she could make a ball of light in the palm of her hand. Her brothers played that they were spacemen with plastic ray guns they brought with the cereal packet tokens. But the little game she'd played entirely by herself among the beech trees along the rim of their property was different. In her game, she didn't need a gun or space helmet or lightsaber. In the game Margot played when she was a child, she was enough all by herself.
Hmm. That kind of reminds me of, you know, the movie Frozen.
I know of the movie Frozen. I haven't actually seen it, I will have to admit. But yes, from what I know, exactly so.
Yeah, Elsa has a special power that she can freeze, not people, but just, you know, freeze through her hands or something. And it can be useful, good or evil, but yeah.
Possibly the reason why that's a family movie and this is a book for grown-ups.
Anyway, what's your other one you've got?
So the other book I brought is was on this, I said, was on the short list for the Bailey's Prize, and it's by Madeleine Tien, who lives in Canada, is a Canadian of Chinese origin, a novelist, in, lives in Vancouver, and it's called Do Not Say We Have Nothing. And this book was shortlisted for the Booker Prize as well as being shortlisted for the Bailey's Prize.
Okay.
And this book is set in China. It's a family story. It's a big, thick book, as you can see. And in fact, as it should be, because it covers about seven centuries of Chinese history. It goes back as far as the Civil War, and it takes us up to present times. And in particular, it focuses on the era of the Cultural Revolution mm-hmm. and the effects on Chinese society of the Cultural Revolution. But it's a family story. And the premise for this story is that there is a young woman named Marie who is in Canada and is... lives with her mother in Canada. Her father had disappeared, and then at a certain point they had learned that he had killed himself in Hong Kong. And she sets out to try to piece together the story of what had happened. Her father had been a concert pianist in the Shanghai Conservatory, and it was an organization that, as many other cultural, because it's called the Cultural Revolution, was particularly debilitated under the Cultural Revolution. And a teenage relative arrives from China, whose name is Ai Ming, and she had fled China. This is after Tiananmen Square. And together, they look at these old family notebooks that they have, a set of notebooks that have been brought over from China of obscure origins, which they don't know. But written on the cover is historical records, which has a reference to some old Chinese writings, part of China's, an important part of Chinese culture. And they set to looking at these family stories, copied and recopied, sort of pieced together the story of what had happened to the family. Mm. And it's very moving and not a thriller, unlike The Power. I've got another piece to read.
Oh, good.
What do you think?
Yeah.
So this is told, the narrator, Marie, that I was telling about, is the actually, it's the first-person narration. And she says, "All that afternoon, after Ai Ming and Ma drove away, I sat at the window reading Ma's copy of David Copperfield. Again and again, I returned to the opening lines. Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. About 7 at night, Ma finally came home. I watched her walk across the inner courtyard and ascend the stairs, moving slowly as if the stairs grew invisibly steeper. Her green coat, delicate as a summer leaf, was so familiar to me. She'd had it since before I was born. I watched it rise through the stairwell as if against the flow of time. Seeing me through the glass, she smiled and began to move faster. She was carrying a parcel in her hands, a small white bakery box. I ran to the door and opened it, pulling Ma inside. I had prepared a meal of rice, cucumbers, and hard-boiled eggs, and as we ate, Ma filled the silence by describing in detail how the day had unfolded. The border guard, yawning, had waved them through. On the outskirts of Seattle, they'd run into traffic. They'd stop for hamburgers. Ai Ming had brought my favorite sponge cake and sent it home with Ma in the white bakery box. Ma had waited until Ai Ming boarded the Greyhound. She'd watch the bus pull away and disappear. After dinner, Ma telephoned Shanghai, speaking for over an hour with Ai Ming's mother. I sat beside her on the sofa, near enough that her voice covered me. In bed that night, I concentrated with all my strength, hoping I could hear my father's voice if only I listened hard enough. Light and shadow slid across the ceiling, now here, now gone, and as I thought about the reasons Ba had left this world, sadness overwhelmed me. Yet the wind sounded against the windows, and in the next room, Ma still breathed and changed and dreamed. I wanted to go to her. I wanted to find a way to protect her. Ai Ming had left me a letter, which I picked up again. We told each other secretly in the quiet midnight world that we wished to fly in heaven, two birds joined wingtip to wingtip, and to grow together on the earth, two branches of one tree. Earth endures, heaven endures, even though both shall end."
Well, that sounds really good. I love family sagas.
Well, that's for you then.
Yeah, Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Madeleine Tien. Right. Oh, we'll take a break, dear. We're going to listen to You're So Vain by Carly Simon, and we'll be right back.
You walked into the party like you were walking onto
Welcome back. You're listening to The Book Chooks on Planet 104.6 FM in Auckland, New Zealand. If you missed the first half of our show, you can download and listen to us online at planetaudio.org.nz/bookchooks.
Also, check out our Goodreads group. The link is on the website, where you'll find the list of what we're reading on the bookshelf.
Hey, Karen. Do Not Say We Have Nothing is quite a thick book. It's like, what, 466 pages. But did you say 7 centuries of Chinese history?
Oh, my. Did I? I meant 7 decades. I think I might have said 7 centuries. You know, Chinese history is very long.
Yeah. No, I think, yeah, that will be worth putting on request for me.
Yes.
Anyway, you're so vain. You probably think this song is about you. And, well, one of my reading challenges, I'm in a group called the Goodreads. It's a Goodreads website, and you can join book groups on there. So I'm in a autobiography, memoir, and biography group, and we all talk about nonfiction books. And one of the members there set up a challenge that we all kind of read the same, not the same book, but maybe the same topic. And one lady picked American Presidents. And so I thought I might read this one, by the current American president, called Trump, The Art of the Deal. And it's, his memoir. It was written back in 1987. So this was before he was elected or became president. And it's written with Tony Schwartz, who is the ghostwriter. Well, actually, it's he wrote the book, but Donald Trump, of course, gets the credit. And it was a bit of a challenge because this is not a book I would ordinarily pick. And so then we say what book we're reading and then we have a discussion about it online. So if anyone's looking online for book discussions, go on Goodreads. Book Chooks has its own group. So hopefully you can join up and see us on there. Anyway, so Trump, The Art of the Deal, the first part of the book was about a week in the life of his doing deals with everyone. So he's on the phone and saying he's got a lot of money and would you do a deal with this? And then it was just like a whirlwind of all the people he talks to. And then he starts talking or writing about in the book how he got started and his family background and everything. So I'll just read a little bit so to give you an idea of what Donald Trump says about himself. How about that?
One of the main things Donald Trump says about himself.
Okay.
You've actually...
So on page 46 in Trump Cards, the elements of the deal, he's got Think Big. I like thinking big. I always have. To me, it's very simple. If you're going to be thinking anyway, you might as well think big. Most people think small because most people are afraid of success, afraid of making decisions, afraid of winning, and that gives people like me a great advantage. My father built low-income and middle-income buildings in Brooklyn and Queens, but even then, I gravitated to the best location. When I was working in Queens, I always wanted Forest Hills. And as I grew older and perhaps wiser, I realised that Forest Hills was great, but Forest Hills isn't Fifth Avenue. And so I began to look toward Manhattan, because at a very early age, I had a true sense of what I wanted to do. I wasn't satisfied just to earn a good living. I was looking to make a statement. I was out to build something monumental, something worth a big effort. Plenty of other people could buy and sell little brownstones or build cookie-cutter red brick buildings. What attracted me was the challenge of building a spectacular development on almost 100 acres by the river on the west side of Manhattan, or creating a huge new hotel next to Grand Central Station at Park Avenue and 42nd Street. The same sort of challenge is what attracted me to Atlantic City. It's nice to build a successful hotel. It's a lot better to build a hotel attached to a huge casino that can earn 50 times what you'd ever earn renting hotel rooms. You're talking a whole different order of magnitude. One of the key things to thinking big is total focus. I think of it almost as a controlled neurosis, which is a quality I've noticed in many highly successful entrepreneurs. They're obsessive, they're driven, they're single-minded, and sometimes they're almost maniacal. But it's all challenged into their work. Where other people are paralyzed by neurosis, the people I'm talking about are actually helped by it. I don't say this track leads to a happier life or a better life, but it's great when it comes to getting what you want. This is particularly true in New York real estate, where you're dealing with some of the sharpest, toughest, and most vicious people in the world. I happen to love to go up against these guys, and I love to beat them. So there you go. That's what Donald Trump says about himself, or what his ghostwriter writes.
It's quite revealing where he said it's not about getting a happier life or a better life, but it's about getting what you want.
I find that
very interesting concept.
Yes. So when I said I would read this book, no one else wanted to read it. But they were reading books about other American presidents. But one lady in the group said, after you've read this article written by the ghostwriter where he's like remorseful about having written this book for Donald Trump. And so she gave me the link to The New Yorker, which is a magazine in New York that deals with current events. And it says, Donald's Trump ghostwriter tells all. The art of the deal made America see Trump as a charmer with an unfailing knack for business. Tony Schwartz helped create that myth and regrets it. Yeah, and the whole article is about him, how he wrote the book with Donald Trump, and he obviously did it for the money. But he did say it was like putting lipstick on a pig. Yeah, it says here, I put lipstick on a pig, he said. I feel a deep sense of remorse that I contributed to presenting Trump in a way that brought him wider attention and made him more appealing than he is. He went on, I genuinely believe that if Trump wins and gets the nuclear codes, there is an excellent possibility it will lead to the end of civilization. Yeah, if he were writing The Art of the Deal today, Schwartz said, it would be a very different book with a very different title. Asked what he would call it, he answered, the sociopath.
Well, I suppose, he shouldn't be ashamed, because ghostwriting is a time-honored profession.
Right.
Trump put his name on the cover of the book, which is actually interesting. I would have expected that he would have hidden some people do hide the names of their ghostwriters, but more and more ghostwriting is coming into its own as a profession, and they are getting their names as written together with, or in collaboration with, or as told to. So it's just like, when you have to defend a criminal in the adversarial court system, everybody has the right to the best defense they can get.
Yeah,
everybody
true.
Has the right to the best book that can be written about them.
Mm.
I suppose. I'm putting in a I suppose.
Yeah.
Certainly Barack Obama's books, I read Dreams from My Father, and I thought it was a wonderful book, totally on his own merits, clearly a different level of ability to write. I actually found a book in the library called Reading with the Stars, which is a celebration of books in libraries, and it features various famous people, among whom are Barack Obama, who's actually included a recommended reading list.
Oh, what did he recommend?
He wants everyone to have read in their life The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, The Catcher in the Rye, and I don't know if you know this book, but it's a classic childhood. Goodnight Moon?
No,
Goodnight Moon
is
a little board book for very small children that you puts them to sleep by. You read, they go around all the things in the room. Goodnight Bed, Goodnight Lamp, Goodnight Moon. Beautiful little book.
I don't know if Trump would have recommended any books, because he doesn't seem to read many.
Well, he probably reads his own books and his family's books. But so Barack Obama's family, so they're writing, they'll all be writing. I think, is Michelle writing an autobiography? Or she's already written one? But Michelle is close to our heart. I think I can say our easily here. She's close to our heart, Selena.
Okay. Yes.
Michelle is wonderful. And because you love gardening, I brought you this book from the library called American Grown by Michelle Obama, The Story of the White House Kitchen Garden and Gardens Across America.
Oh, thank you.
It's a book encouraging people to plant kitchen gardens in their backyard or on their deck.
Come into the White House Kitchen Garden with me as we share our story and stories of gardens across America. Learn about what we can do together to give our children the happy, healthy futures they deserve. First Lady Michelle Obama. Wow.
She's even included some recipes see in the back of the book to get your children to eat more fruits and veggies, or even possibly yourself. You might also be someone who balks at boiled green beans.
Cauliflower, mac and cheese.
There you go.
It's got a recipe in here. Oh, good. Thank you. I've got to have to borrow this one and have a really good read of it.
I think it's the season for cauliflower. Isn't cauliflower one of the winter vegetables?
Yes, you can grow cauliflower if you put it, you get your seedlings in the ground. Yeah, winter veggie. Yeah, that's great. That might be my next American president-related book.
Yeah.
Yeah. One more book, What I Learned from God While Gardening. I love gardening books. But I just had a little quote here, which I'll leave with you. It says on Wildflowers on page 30, there's a little quote. The impersonal hand of government can never replace the helping hand of a neighbour, by Hubert H. Humphrey. And it's about talking about gardening, and you share with your neighbours when you garden. So
Hubert H. Humphrey, who was a vice president of America, almost a president, but didn't quite make it.
Well, that's all we have time for, I'm afraid. But thank you so much, Karen, for coming and sharing.
My pleasure, Selena, as always. Thank you.
Happy reading, everyone.